Welcome to Syntax. Today we got a pretty exciting new episode of some big news for Syntax here. We have hired a new content creator. Welcome to CJ. Hey.
Hello.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So you might have seen, we posted it out on the socials. We put a couple videos up as well. But we had been, man, it's been a couple months we've been sort of working on this, looking for, we both hired a producer as well as we were looking for another person to start to take on some more of the content that we're looking to do here at Syntax. Not just podcasts, but we kind of want to go a little bit more into video and other mediums. So we are super stoked to have CJ on board, and we're going to have him on the podcast today just to sort of talk about, just get to know him, you know, and what his plans are for what the stuff he's going to do, as well as like kind of keyboard do you use. I'm curious about that as well.
Sure.
Yeah. So welcome. We should say his name is CJ Reynolds. Wes, you did not say his last name. So welcome,
sorry.
CJ. And yeah, this is going to be really fun, just getting to know CJ and all about what he's doing. But if you're like us and you just added someone to your team, there's a good chance you're going to introduce some bugs into your code. Now, I would probably put the likelihood of me introducing bugs into the code base more so than CJ here. So if you add someone new to your code, you're going to have some bugs. So head on over to century.io/syntax, sign up today, get 2 months for free, and you will be able to solve, find, and really understand any of the issues that occur on your website. And guess what? You could even create a GitHub issue for them right there and attach it to the new guy. Hey, CJ, hey, fix this bug that we got that I made. So that's it. CJ, what's up? How you doing, my man?
Doing good. I woke up not feeling well, but I took some meds. I'm hanging in there. So
yeah, power through, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So we had a bit of an interview process, and like Wes said, it was kind of months long. It took a long time, but I want to like let everybody know, you know, CJ was really impressive to us for a lot of reasons. Beyond doing Coding Garden, which is his YouTube channel and Twitch channel where he live streamed. CJ is just a really smart dude. He's been around the Denver scene here for a while. And you know what? Everybody we've ever talked to has nothing but great things to say about CJ and the work he's produced. So we are just extremely stoked to have him on the team. CJ, do you want to give us a brief introduction to who you are? And then we can get into some questions to get to know CJ a little bit better.
Sure. I am CJ. A lot of people actually didn't know my last name, so it's cool if you just call me CJ as well. But yeah, I've been into computers and tech all my life. The first website I built, I was like 12, and I built a Calvin and Hobbes fan site. From there, I started building and fixing computers. Eventually got a computer science degree. I worked for a very large enterprise building desktop apps. Then I started teaching full stack web development. And then I worked at a consultancy where I worked from the front end to the back end, also in DevOps, kind of just architecting apps and building them. And then most recently, I've been working on and at Coding Garden full time, where I do live coding live streams. So typically I'll go live, I'll build apps from scratch, I'll solve algorithmic problems, I'll answer code questions, kind of just hang out with people and do cool code things. So yeah, that's me.
Nice. And, you know, one thing that you've brought here is a much needed green palette to the video pod here. Wes and I kind of skew towards blues here, and CJ is bringing all the green. It looks really great here if you're on the video podcast
on YouTube. Oh, you mean the background,
YouTube.
I see.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, he's not a green developer, if that's what you thought. No.
Oh, that's not. Yeah, that's definitely not the direction I was going in. What did you build that Calvin and Hobbes set in, by the way? I'm curious.
Yeah, so it was mainly HTML and CSS, and I used FrontPage. I used like drag and drop, and it was hosted on Tripod.
Tripod, oh, man. Yes. Yeah. I've also hosted on Tripod. Or did you ever get into AngelFire or GeoCities?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I bounced between them. There was Lycos, Tripod, AngelFire,
yeah,
maybe a few others, yeah.
Free servers was where I was at.
Free servers, yeah. AngelFire was my stomping ground. That's definitely where I hung out. So how, besides like the Calvin and Hobbes site, how did you get into web dev? Was it like, I want to make a Calvin and Hobbes site and therefore I need to learn how to do it? Or was it, this kind of thing is interesting, let me build a Calvin and Hobbes site?
No, it was exactly that. It was like, I want to share my passion with the world. How do I do this? And so I kind of like figured it out. And that was like early days. Eventually, I also started working on like MySpace themes. So that was like mostly CSS. And then I was working on like Flash embeds for MySpace as well. So like doing ActionScript and stuff like that. But yeah, honestly, most of the stuff I've done has kind of just been, I want to do the thing. So I have to figure out how to do the thing versus the reverse, I guess.
I think that's probably why you stuck out to us in this whole interview process. Is Scott and I are very much the same way, is that like, we'll figure it out. Like I'll take on anything and figure it out. And sometimes that leads to some missteps. Like on a Friday, I realized that our entire MySQL database had no indexes. And I was like, why the hell is this thing timing out? You know, like we, yeah. I was like looking at the transcript, function that we have, and it goes off and merges the MP3s together and then fetches the transcripts and comes back. And I was like, why is this taking, it was timing out a couple times, to save it into the database and to query for existing ones. I was like, that's really weird. It shouldn't be that slow. I sort of took a look into it and I was like, oh damn. Like we were using Prisma has like this like virtual relations where it's not actually using foreign keys, which we had to use that because we were using Planet Scale, right? And Planet Scale, actually, I found out earlier that Planet Scale rolled out foreign keys like an hour before I discovered this. But anyways, we had an issue. I threw some indexes on there and it worked. But like we're willing to take on anything and learn as you go. And you're very much the same way, right? You've always just been a curious guy.
For sure. Yeah. Cause I mean, I also, besides like coding and dev, like I've gotten into like making, not so much recently, but for a while I was working on a camper van, like trying to build it from scratch. And
yeah,
I play music. So like I've been building out a guitar, so I have to like solder it and like, I attached a neck to it and stuff like that. So like, yeah, even beyond coding, if I want to do something, I kind of just try to figure it out.
Yeah. That fits really well. So you're into music. What kind of instruments you play other than guitar?
So I'm a mediocre musician. I'm like mediocre at everything. Guitar is probably my best instrument. I'm still not that good, but I also play bass. I can play drums. And then I know what the keys are on the keyboard and I know enough to figure them out that I can sequence them to sound good, but I can't really play like with two-handed piano.
Nice. Yeah. We recently got an electric piano that has like a real piano key feel in the house. And it's so nice to just have one around because I'm not like a trained pianist. I took piano lessons many times in my life, but like I'm not great. But it's just so nice to have the piano to sit down, bang out some notes, you know, get some vibes going and just feel like you can create something like that. How did you know you wanted to do this as a career?
For sure.
Versus a hobby, yeah.
I would say, so like the early days of like building websites, like I really didn't even think of it as software development early on. It was kind of just like, again, like I had a problem I wanted to solve, so I did it. But then eventually working on computers and doing like troubleshooting for computers, I did that for a very long time. I was like building computers from scratch, like in high school. Mm. And so like I got pretty good at that. And so I was like, all right, if I can build the thing, I know how the computer itself works, all the parts and the pieces, but how do I actually make my own apps? You know, like how can I build something that like runs on the desktop? Cause like that was elusive to me even when I started getting a computer science degree. So like that was my main motivation. I was like, all right, I've figured out the machine. Now I want to figure out how can I actually make things happen on the screen.
Yeah. Like I feel like that's always the next level to being like a techie, right? Like you can do all the gear, you can dial in all the settings, but eventually it's going to come to a point where you want to do something that is so custom that you can't string together a bunch of stuff and you're going to have to learn to code it yourself. So I remember that as well, being like, I just want to be able to like make my own thing. You know, how do people make these apps? And slowly but surely you sort of figure it out.
Yeah.
I'm curious about the computer science degree as well. So Scott and I both don't have comp sci degrees. Do you feel like the comp sci degree helps you as a web developer and like what parts, if so?
I think a lot of times it's like unconscious help. Like there's things that I learned that I'm not immediately reaching for, but like I learned them. So like, they're kind of like there when I'm solving other types of problems. Because like, Yeah, so I later in my career, I transitioned into full stack development, and never once am I actually like working on algorithms from scratch or data structures and stuff like that. But if I'm, let's say I'm working in a Redux store in a React app, and maybe I want to make sure that like the immutable state updates are a bit more performant, I feel like I tend to reach for the like slightly more performant solution first, just because I've thought a lot about like, well, and I've in the computer science degree, it's always talking about performance and lookup time and stuff like that. So I think that's probably where it helps me. But it is hard to say, because it's in the day to day, like I'm not doing algorithms and data structures. So yeah, ultimately I think it's kind of like an unconscious help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting that you say that, because it does kind of seem like you got to skip a step that I think some developers, like, I don't know, I don't want to put Wes in this boat, but definitely myself, where like as an immature developer, I'm going to reach for the thing that's easiest, the thing that is like the least resistance, and not even like think about the performance implication of that. And yeah. I was like a more mature developer. It's like, oh, wait, maybe the simplest solution isn't always the best solution in that regard. So it seems like you did get to skip maybe that step of being the immature developer.
Yeah. If you've seen the meme of the there's like the bell curve of like, here you're like a beginner developer. I guess I can't think of the specifics, but basically
it's
I feel
the midwit like, meme. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I'm on the far end where like now I will reach for the simple solutions, but I at least have the know-how and the tools to be like, well, maybe it's not that performant, so I can like tweak it. But yeah, I feel like I'm on the far end of that bell curve now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll give an example to listeners of sure. something where a comps high person might do. So last week, I remembered that you can download a text file of every single domain name registered per TLD. So I downloaded every single .com domain name. And pop quiz, how big do you think the text file of every single domain name in the world is?
10 gigs?
Terabyte?
It's a text file. Yeah, I don't know.
It's a text file, and it has... It's like a DNS record, so it points to I guess name servers. Yeah,
okay.
It was 4 gigs as a gzipped, and ungzipped it was 24 gigs.
Yeah,
and I was like, man, that's wild. I was like, I'm curious what's the longest domain name out there? You know, I wrote a little script with Dino that would read it in. It obviously can't read a 24 gig file into memory, right? You have to stream it in chunks and work with it. So I was streaming in every single chunk and processing the chunk as it came in. And if it was long enough, I would throw that into an array. And if it wasn't, I would just let it go. And yeah. It would fall over after a couple of minutes because it ran out of memory. And I was like, man, like, I'm not sure. Like, I thought if I just streamed it, it would just garbage collect. But it obviously wasn't, you know, like those chunks were being saved in memory somewhere. And I was like kind of looking at it like, hi, oh, I wonder where I'm going wrong here. But like you would probably immediately think, I wonder what's the most like memory performant way to sort of handle this thing. Because obviously we don't have enough RAM on our computer to hold a 24 gig TXT file.
Right. For sure.
Wes, I think I have like 64 gigs of RAM. So
yeah, me too. But there's limits to like what a process would have. I think it hit, I forget what it was. It was kind of interesting watching the activity monitor just climb and climb. And then it hit like 8 gigs and fell over.
Wes, I'm going to tell you. I just did I was testing a bunch of GitHub Actions locally, and they have to run through this whole Docker setup, right? And I was getting resource issues. It would always just say I was running out of resources in my container. So I told Docker to just take every bit of resource on my entire computer as possible when I run these GitHub Actions. And simply just telling it to run GitHub Actions locally brought my computer to a crawl, took every single resource that I had.
So we had made an issue about building a GitHub action that would check our markdown files. We'll talk more about it on another episode, but Scott was like, hey, I'll take this on, sounds fun. I was like, good luck. Like, good luck. And then, like a week later, he comes to me, he's like, damn, this GitHub Actions won't run locally. Oh. And like, I was like, I knew this would happen. I'm so glad you're doing it.
I complained to my wife. I said, I cannot believe I jumped in. I eagerly jumped in on this thing that was a total landmine. And I knew it was because I've worked enough in GitHub Actions to know. But I was like, oh, this sounds interesting. And then I'm like, why? Why did I do that? Okay. Yeah, let's get back to CJ. What was your what was your very first web dev job like?
Sure. So I had various jobs. I guess like the first software job wasn't web dev.
Interesting.
And the first internship I had, I was a system administrator. I guess what do you want to hear about?
Let's hear about the first software job and then the first web dev job specifically.
Okay, gotcha. So I was working, this was fresh out of college, and I was working with C# and .NET to build desktop applications. Mm. And so that job, I guess, was interesting because I had never worked with C# in university. So it was kind of like, all right, you have a few weeks, maybe a month or so to kind of get up to speed, learn the language. They threw me into like a pretty large project. And honestly, I talk about this a lot, but that project that I worked on, that very first project, kind of informed the way I think about and build applications even today, because it was like a very well-structured, object-oriented, very large application with a lot of like dependencies everywhere and everything. And so, yeah, basically just getting into that code base and learning how everything worked and how everything hooked up, and then eventually becoming an owner of that code base. So I worked that job for about 6 months, and then the lead on that team moved on and I became the lead all of a sudden. Wow. So it was now my job to maintain the code base. So it wasn't initially my code base, but after 6 months, like basically like I was, it was now my code base. Like I knew it in and inside and out. And so, yeah, the day to day was kind of working in that code base. And so the app itself was a desktop app that did data visualization. So there were modules for different types of data visualization. So there was like a bar chart and a line graph and a heat map. And then there were mechanisms for importing data and basically creating like reusable data sets that you could like drag and drop onto the various visualizations. So yeah, I learned a ton about visualizing things and working with large data sets. I learned about like data decimation. That's where like you have like thousands and thousands of data points and it wouldn't actually make sense to draw them all on the screen. So you decimate them, you break that up, and then only draw like every tenth data point, or like the average of every 10 data points, and then it ends up looking about the same on the screen, but you use a lot less processing to actually display it.
Decimation's a cool name for that.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was my first dev job. I don't know. Yeah, I guess anything you want to know about it or what I should talk about?
No, I think that's a really cool to know. You know, I had a kind of a similar experience where with my first job, I had eventually, you know, my boss had moved on and I took on the senior role from him, and it puts you in such a weird position. It's interesting that you had to do that with C# after not doing any C# before your career.
Exactly.
Yeah. What about your first web dev job? So like, how did you go from C# to websites?
Sure. And so this was the same job, but I kind of like made web dev my job. So
cool.
And this is also why I like lean heavily towards web dev these days, is because like in working on desktop apps, specifically Windows desktop apps, they only run on Windows, right? And so if you want something to run on a phone or any other type of device, you need to build a separate app for that or build a website for that. And so one of the projects I was working on, this was actually, it was software that needed to run in the field. And they had really, really old computers out there. So the actual UI was just printed reports. So the software would run on the back end, but the output that they would get would literally every morning would run a job that would print out the charts and their plans for the day. And I was like, well, that's really cumbersome and manual. So I was like, what if we had a website that just showed us the data in real time? And so I initially built it with jQuery, and then I learned about this cool thing called AngularJS, and I started to build it out with AngularJS. And it's actually super interesting because AngularJS, and we're talking about Angular 1 here, the old Angular, it introduced, well, not didn't introduce, but it used an idea of data binding, and that actually came from the C# world. So in C# I was working on an app called, or a platform called WPF, Windows Presentation Foundation, and it introduced this idea of data binding. And then the creator of AngularJS like kind of was informed by that as well. So it's like building apps in a similar way, but now they can run in the web, they can run on any device. And so yeah, that was my first exposure to like web tech.
Wow. So that it's so interesting how many parallels you have to Wes and I. I mean, Wes and I, we both got started doing kind of like hobbyist sites. I think Wes did like a, was it like a PlayStation fan site, even though you didn't play video games? Was that it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's still up. PS20.itgo.com.
Nice.
It's wild that it's still up, but yeah, it's, I got really into building the website and not so much into actually playing the PlayStation.
Yeah. And then we moved into MySpace themes. We both, you know, got our you know, hands dirty with Angular 1 as being kind of a, these big, you know, client-side JavaScript apps. I know, you know, Wes and I were doing, I don't know, did you ever do Backbone, Wes? I did some Backbone.
Yeah, I did a couple. I had taken on a couple, like, freelancing projects from existing Backbone applications, so I thought that was kind of interesting to see how they were all set up. And like I was like big into like CoffeeScript as well at the time. Same. So that was like the Angular and like the Backbone eras were just like magical times of like wild major major shifts forward in building these web apps.
Yeah.
What's the worst thing you've ever had to do professionally as a developer?
Okay, I would probably say the first internship I had, it wasn't exactly a dev job, it was system administration, but the reason it was so bad is because I never had anything to do. Like, first of all, I had an hour commute, so I would commute an hour there, and then they would have nothing for me to do, so I would just sit and browse Reddit, browse Hacker News, and, I mean, that's when I learned that, like, I need to be doing something. Like, I can't just collect a paycheck, like, I need to be actively doing something. So that was probably the worst job I had. Funnily enough, like, I actually made work for myself. So my job was to manually upgrade websites that were running Java and Tomcat. They were upgrading from MySQL databases to Postgres database. And when I got the job, they gave me a manual like this thick that was like, this is the first step you need to do to upgrade, and this is the next step. And I was like, you know what? This can be automated. So I took that manual and I turned it into a bash script where you, like, literally, it used to take an hour to upgrade a site. Now you would run my script, it would ask you a couple of questions, and it would upgrade the site in like 2 minutes. I flipped kind of like the worst job into like a more fun job where I actually got to write some code as well.
Nice. I love that.
All right, let's talk about like stuff you've built in the past. Is there, sure. I know you've made all kinds of interesting stuff, but do you have any interesting stories of things you've made in the past?
Yeah, like you said, I've done a lot of things. I would honestly, the most fun and interesting stuff is some of the stuff I've done on Coding Garden. So yeah. one of the apps we built was called isitnewyearsday.com. You can actually go there right now, and it will show everyone's mouse on the screen that's on the site.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and if you click, it'll do like little fireworks. But the fun part about building this is it's actually internationalized. And so on, for those listening on the podcast, on the screen, it actually says 10 months, 11 days, 14 hours, 16 minutes, 14 seconds until New Year's Day. But we internationalized it into like, I think at least 20 different languages. Oh, and that was super fun to learn about. Like, it's not as simple as just find and replace, right? You don't just change months to be another language. Like, in some languages, it makes sense to have the sentence where, like, New Year's Day is at the beginning versus at the end. And so this project was super fun because there was a bunch of people that contributed translations, and we came up with, like, a custom way of translating it. And then also, like, building out the real-timeness of, like, having your mouse on the site and seeing other people there. We used Socket.io and WebSockets for that. But it was fun to figure out, well, how can you have 100 people on this site all with their mouse moving and not crash the server? So it's actually like it's averaging out your mouse movements, and then it sends like every 500 milliseconds, it sends where your mouse was to the server, and the server maintains that state. And then when it sends it to the other clients, it actually draws it out with CSS animation. So instead of like having to every single mouse movement, it'll like animated across like an average of mouse movement. So that was fun to figure out.
And it looks smooth for that. You'd think sometimes that could get wonky. I know me personally, if I opt for, you know, using CSS animations while I'm also trying to plot in values with JavaScript, it's easy for that to feel wrong. And this doesn't feel wrong at all. So sick. Yeah. That's really cool.
And I got another weird or fun one. Dung Hero, dunghero.online. Are you all familiar with Dev Ed? He has a pretty big YouTube channel, developed by Ed. He put out a game challenge. He was like an hour game challenge. Like, what can you build in an hour? And so I built this, and I built it on stream. So there's a stream of me building this live. And the idea is that, so you see a website, you see a bunch of animals jumping around, and they're leaving little poop emojis. And in the top right is the number of dungs that have been collected. And so multiple people can be on the site, and you click on the dungs to collect them, and you just try to get that number as high as possible. It's kind of like a multiplayer cookie clicker kind of thing.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Click on that's hilarious.
Yeah. And what's also fun about this is this site has been running, it crashed at one point, but I think at this point it's been up for at least a year and a half, and it's just a long-running node server. So that number in the top right is literally just a number stored in memory in node, so it's not even a database. It's just a process that's running, and it just keeps track of that number of clicks on the site. Yeah.
That's so cool.
I'm trying to game it right now.
Yeah. That's classic Wes here.
There's protections against it. You can try. But you'll notice, like, if you try to click too fast, the emoji will reappear. There's the server side prevents an IP from clicking too many too fast.
Oh, cool. Did you know that on the click event, there is the click event, there's a is trusted Boolean, which will give you, we did it in my whack-a-mole course on my JavaScript 30 course because people would just go into DevTools and fire off a click. But there's an is trusted, which will only fire on mouse and keyboard events and not by simulated events, which I thought was interesting.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I have to use that.
What is some tech that you're into right now? Like, what's some cool stuff that you feel like inspires you tech-wise?
Definitely. I've been looking a lot into, like, full-stack type safety stuff. It honestly baffles me how long Node.js and the JavaScript and TypeScript ecosystem have been around without having mechanisms for that, like really like sharing types between front-end and back-end, having more structured code bases. So Hono is really cool. I've been looking into Hono. And then also frameworks that introduce opinions. So like Adonis.js is one I haven't tried yet, but I want to give it a try because it's people talk about it as kind of like the Laravel of the JavaScript world. Mm. Yeah. And so it has opinions about where do things go and a lot of stuff built in. And you kind of see that trend happening in the JavaScript and TypeScript world, especially with meta frameworks like Svelte and Next.js and even Nuxt.js on the Vue side. For a while, they were just trying to figure things out of like, all right, how do we get hybrid rendering and how do we get sites easily built with this tech? But now you can see things popping up like Blitz.js, if you've heard of that, that's built on top of Next. And it tries to introduce more opinions and give more code structure. So those are the kinds of things I'm excited about. It's just cleaner and more opinionated and predictable code bases, basically.
Yeah. And you do a lot of this stuff on your Coding Garden streams. You had like a Try Day Friday where you were just trying new stuff. And I was watching one time, you just had like a massive list of stuff you wanted to try. You were organizing into different types of things.
Exactly,
is that like something that you get joy from, is trying a bunch of different new tech?
Definitely. I mean, I think that's one thing that can happen if you just only use one type of tech or one platform for a really long time, is you miss out on what the other languages and frameworks and ecosystems are doing. So more recently, I tried Laravel for the first time, and it was really cool to see how everything is just built in. And then like a few weeks later, I tried Java Spring Boot. And again, a bunch of stuff built in. It does a lot for you. So it's like, I think the people that are creating these types of frameworks in the JavaScript and TypeScript world, they're pulling influences from other languages, other frameworks, other platforms. And so, yeah, for me, it's super fun to just see what's out there and see what's beyond JavaScript, basically.
Yeah, I think so many people miss that context of the outside of their bubble, right? You know, I know for me personally, the moment I try something that's outside of my bubble and it gives me this whole other viewpoint on what I'm doing, you start to realize that like maybe the way that you're doing things all the time isn't necessarily always the best or the right one just because it feels right. There's all these different approaches. And that recently hit me with the whole HTMX thing. Not that like I want to build everything in HTMX now. I think I'm still firmly in the Svelte world. But when I tried HTMX, it was kind of like, oh, this is very different than what I do. And it's making me think differently about how I approach problems. So that's pretty cool that you get to do stuff like that.
Did you see, first of all, CJ, did you see the new Hano 4.0 features?
I did. I haven't had a chance to try it, but it looks pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're going like, they support React components. They're going front end, which is wild. And I was just like, this is a major change. But I think that's the thing is like, I've used Hano for a lot of stuff. And then I go, yeah, I kind of want the front end as well, because I'm not building API endpoints. I want the whole meta framework. And I think Cloudflare realizes that, like, the reason why Vercel makes a lot of money is because they have Next.js, right? And if Cloudflare can, obviously Cloudflare can run Next.js, but if they can make their own version of that, I wonder if that's kind of what they're gunning for.
Definitely.
But, and Scott, did you see the HTMZ pop-up yesterday?
I absolutely saw HTMZ. Yes, I did. I pawed all through that, and I thought briefly to myself, oh, I should use this, and I thought, I got better things to do right now.
I haven't. What is it?
It's like HTMX, but instead of custom attributes, it just uses IDs.
And like non-standard HTML elements. So like non-standard elements. And what's cool about it is they say that the whole library is enough JavaScript for just a simple script tag on your site. Like you don't have like any JavaScript really to do it. So it's also very low feature. You can't like replace multiple areas like you can in HTMX, but pretty interesting.
Yeah, it just goes to show how close we're getting with the browser to actually having something like this natively, you know?
Well, it's been like a desire for the longest time, like the introduction of web components. Everyone for the longest time was like, all right, web components are going to kill front end frameworks and it's all just going to be built into the browser, but we really never saw that. But yeah, it is exciting to use less frameworks if it's just built in. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah. What is your go-to framework if you were to build a startup today, what would your stack be?
Probably SvelteKit. I've spent the most time with it more recently. For the longest time I was doing React professionally, but I was doing Vue for all my side projects, and I actually ran the Vue.js meetup here in Denver. As a joke, we kind of called it the Vue support group, because like no one actually used Vue as their full-time job. They would just go there to talk about Vue. I've always been a fan of things that like get rid of the boilerplate, make things simpler, and Svelte kind of ticks all those boxes. So yeah, I build things with Svelte these days.
Yeah, that was kind of me too. I did React professionally, but Svelte was always my hobby. And then when we got a chance to rebuild Level Up Tutorials, I'm like, I'm picking SvelteKit. When we got a chance to build a new syntax site, picking SvelteKit. So now I got to surround myself with SvelteKit, and life is good. What's your tech setup? Let's get into some of that stuff. What are you working with? What's your editor? Sure.
So I use VS Code. I have a theme. I think it's called JS, or Just Dark is what it's called. If you go to github.com/codinggarden/VS Code-settings, it has all the extensions I use, the font I use and everything. But yeah, I like a nice dark and high contrast theme. I'm running on an M1 Mac from, I think, 2021. My keyboard is, actually, let me look up the exact name really quick. Yeah, so my keyboard is the RK Royal Kluge G68. So I'm using a different keyboard here because I don't want the clicky sound when I'm like on video. This is the one that I use. It's got a nice, cool red and gray and black color theme. And I do like the 65% keyboards because they take up less space. So I use that.
Yeah, so like let's explain what that is. A 65% keyboard means that it's what? 65% of the size of a regular one?
Exactly.
Where does that come from?
So if you think of like a full size keyboard would include like a numpad, and then you also have like the arrow keys that are like offset from the rest of the keys. Yeah. Then you have a separate row for the function keys. Yeah. So that's more of a 100% keyboard, I guess.
Yeah.
But this kind of like tries to make it smaller. So it will, you'll see that the arrow keys have been like smooshed into the main body. Mm-hmm. And then the number keys are dual function for also like function and number keys. It's a little cumbersome sometimes because you do have to press like the function modifier to get your F keys. But I like this because it's nice and portable. I can throw it in my backpack, take it with me places. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you use F keys a lot? I recently just turned off. Like, I haven't used F keys since I had a Windows computer because Mac by default makes them into all their buttons. And I was kind of like looking at them and I was like, you know what? I don't use any of these Mac buttons other than maybe the volume ones, but I've got volume, play, pause on my mouse, and I use that 90% of the time. And often you'll look up like a VS Code shortcut, like rename, and it's like F2. I was like, I don't feel like rebinding that. So I just switched. Like, are you a big F key user?
But exactly like you said, that's probably the main place that I use it is, so like go to definition, rename, refactor, but I feel like I don't do those often enough that it's not as cumbersome to just do function key and then the one that I need.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I'm feeling like a total noob because to go to definition, I almost always right click on my mouse and select go to
like
definition.
A noob. Yeah.
That's like the only like really bad mouse thing I do is go to definition or rename symbol. Like I need shortcuts for all those because I use them all the time. Yeah. What about monitor and what kind of monitor do you use?
So for the longest time, I just use my MacBook screen. So I got really used to only using my MacBook because when I live stream, I don't like to have extra screens where I'm like bouncing between stuff. I technically have a separate screen that is attached to my streaming computer. But yeah, for the most part, I just use my laptop screen. And then I have this 22-inch monitor. I have no idea what it is. I've had it for like 5 years that I recently plugged in so I can have like Slack in another window.
Yeah, nice. Move that slide.
And you have a separate computer for streaming?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a Windows, basically like a gaming PC. And one of the main reasons I did that is just so that like my fan laptops, the fans in my laptop wouldn't spin up when I'm streaming because I'm running Docker. I have like a bunch of tabs in my browser open. I have all this stuff. And if I had OBS running as well, then like that just like wouldn't work. And so, yeah, so it's a separate gaming computer. I have like two HDMI capture cards, one for the camera, one for the PC. And then I've got an audio interface that plugs into that as well.
Oh, cool. And but have you tried that on you have an M1? Mm-hmm. Has that changed at all? Does it still spin up? Because I'm trying to think, like, if I've had this M1 for a long time, and I don't know if I've ever heard the fans turn on.
I agree with that. I haven't heard the fans turn on, but I haven't tried streaming directly from it. I think I'm also kind of like set in my ways. Like I have my stream set up where I can just go live. So I haven't tested out anything new, but I mean, you're completely right. Like this thing is quiet. Like I've never heard it spin up.
Yeah. I was having like mouse lagging issues with OBS the other day though, that I couldn't figure out. So like there was something that was chugging it, and it was weird because none of my processes were pegged or memory was fine. I couldn't really figure it out, but well, I got to dig more into it.
Yeah. In my experience, the moment you touch your streaming setup, it all breaks because I never had it dialed in, and then I would like modify just ever so slightly. And then next thing you know, I'm, you know, deep into OBS. Let's talk about your streaming stuff though. Let's go deep on this stuff. Like,
sounds good.
How did you choose to like get into streaming specifically? Was it difficult to go live and feel comfortable being live on the internet?
I mean, it took a while. So initially, I started live streaming because I was teaching at a coding school. And I actually took a 3-month break from that, but I wanted to like keep teaching. So I was like, I should try this live streaming thing. But yeah, it took a long time before I got comfortable. And I think like one of the things I had to do early on was just pretend like I'm in front of I'm in the classroom and I'm kind of just doing my thing, like pay less attention to like the view count. If people come into the chat, do my best to like interact and talk to them. But a lot of times to develop a persona and like get comfortable, you kind of just have to stream like everyone's watching or like no one's watching, I guess, whatever works for how you're comfortable, you know?
Yeah, that was, I don't know. Did that ever like bug you if you saw like zero people watching or anything like that? I have no idea how that onboarding would have felt.
No, it did, but I think that's kind of why I had to hide it at a certain point. It was just like, people were showing up and watching, I guess, like because of me. So as long as I was myself and I was doing my thing, I felt like people would eventually come. And I guess the other thing is, so I started live streaming on YouTube. And the nice thing about YouTube is like the discoverability. So that first live stream I did, there were like maybe two people in the chat. And that's just because like I sent a link to my friend and they like opened it up, which actually is a pro tip. If you're starting to stream, your friends and your family should at least open it up so it bumps that view count a little bit.
No, that is totally a pro tip. Yeah. my wife likes every single one of our TikToks. She likes and bookmarks every single one of our TikToks just for that extra push.
But talking about discoverability, so yeah, two or three people actually watched live, but because it's that YouTube live stream now becomes a VOD, it has thousands of views now. And so that was the nice thing about starting streaming on YouTube initially, is that even if when I was live, only a few people watched, eventually other people would go back and find the live stream, then they would subscribe, and then eventually they would come in and start hanging out in the live chat. Mm. So yeah, it was a slow process, but that discoverability, I think, was key early on YouTube.
Yeah, for sure. Why a blue screen? I noticed that you do a blue screen for your green screen. Yep. Is it because you have so much green elsewhere in your office here?
That's exactly it. So I started with a green screen, and then I wanted to, if you look at some of the earliest Coding Garden streams, I wanted to have a little bamboo plant like sitting next to my laptop, but the green screen would key out the leaves of the plant.
Oh, yeah.
And then eventually I got shirts that had like flowers on them. So I was like, all right, I need to figure this out. And so I got a blue screen. But fun fact, have you seen Squid Game?
I have not seen Squid Game. It freaks my wife out, so we don't watch it. Yeah.
I gotcha. But they wear green sports suits or like track suits. And yeah. So all of the keying done in that show was done with blue screens because all of the actors were wearing and actresses are wearing green.
Yeah. I dove into that a little bit in college. I did a short film and we used a blue tarp for it, and we didn't have enough light. And man, the keying was awful. It was so terrible. It took me, like, I had to like manually key so much. I was like rotoscoping. I was like, one bad key. Yeah. What's your philosophy on teaching in general? How, like, I'm sure over time it's changed and you've evolved.
Yeah, because you've taught in person as well, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So I taught at a code school for like roughly 3 years. And honestly, that's kind of where I honed my craft, right? So like being in front of a classroom of 30 students every day and kind of getting the hang of teaching things. And then eventually I started to do like off the cuff lessons. So like instead of like planned lessons, like we're going to teach this and this and this, like there would be some students that were struggling a little bit. So it made a lot of sense to be like, all right, let's just do an impromptu lesson on what the students are having issues with. And so I got the hang of kind of just like writing down a few objectives that we would cover and then going and like kind of like making sure that I cover each objective, which kind of gets into my philosophy, which is like, you maybe don't see it as much on the live stream. It happens every now and then, but I do like to be objective focused. And so these are like actionable things that students should walk away from a lesson. So like you use verbs. One of the concepts that I learned teaching was Bloom's taxonomy. And so this is a bunch of words you can use to describe the type of learning that's going to happen. So and it also like it builds as a pyramid. So at the very bottom is kind of like define and describe. So define HTTP request, right? And describe the HTTP request response cycle. And so that kind of like starts the student with, all right, I have some definitions, I can at least do the descriptions. But then from there, you move on to application. And so then it's, you might say something like, use Node.js and Express to build a web server that handles the HTTP request and response cycle. And so that's also my kind of like my philosophy there as well, is starting with base knowledge and kind of like building up from there.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. I have the same background as well. As I taught in a coding school for a while, both part-time, and I did a couple of the boot camps as well. And that was one thing that really helped me learn to teach, was that like, yeah, you can sit there and talk about these definitions and whatnot. But as soon as I would start to go a little bit off the cuff and be like, hold on, let me show you an example of where I've used that. And let me show you like where you, like, that's my big thing in teaching, is like, where would you actually use that? You know, like what exciting thing? Cause then people's like their brain lights up and go, oh, I see. Or I have an idea of how I could take and move that. So that's really neat that we both have the same kind of outlook on that.
Definitely.
Yeah. Let's talk about some non-coding stuff before we wrap up here. What kind of hobbies do you have? What do you do besides, I know you mentioned, you know, doing some music stuff, but you know, what are your hobbies?
Probably my dog is my biggest hobby. So I have a Saint Bernard. He'll be 8 years old. Wait, is it this week or next week? I think it's this week. He'll be 8 years old.
Nice.
So yeah, we walk him, like we go for multi-hour walks like every weekend, and I take as many breaks as I can to go see him. So I work in my basement, and he's too scared to come down the stairs. So it kind of forces me to at least like leave the desk every hour to like go pet him and like hang out in the backyard.
That's so cool. Yeah. Yeah, that's a Colorado thing, right? The Avalanche, sure. Their mascot is a St. Bernard. So my kids love Bernie. Yeah.
Do you have one of those little kegs that you can put on them to carry stuff
we
around?
We do. I'll share a picture. Maybe Randy can edit it in for the video podcast. But we have some like amazing Christmas photos that we took. He's just so regal, and he's got his barrel there.
He's got his barrel.
Yeah, and then we did the thing. I don't know if you saw it. Like early pandemic, people were putting toilet paper rolls on their dog to look like a barrel. But it's
I have that.
Because of the toilet paper rolls shortage. Yeah, I don't know. We have a pic of that too.
That's so cute.
So besides that, like I mentioned, I like making music, and then more recently, I've been working on like a custom guitar project. So, I got a Squier Starcaster, and I replaced the neck. So I found a neck that is like an old school Stratocaster neck, mm-hmm. and I attached that, and then I installed some Invader pickups in it. I also like skateboarding. I don't skateboard as much lately, especially because there's so much snow on the ground. But I've been skating since I was like 12, and I think like from the age of 12 to 18, I didn't go a single day without skateboarding. And then after that, it's kind of just been on and off. But I think because I did it for so long, all the muscle memory is there, so I can kind of just go like pick it up anytime I want to.
Just get into it. That. I'm like, I push around every now and then, and I showed my kids that I can ollie the other day, but I'm a little bit too scared to like actually go to a park because like if I would, I'm too scared that I'm gonna like break my wrist or something like that, and like I would be out, you know.
I went to a park with Travis Nielsen like a year and a half ago in Hawaii. And it was like a sick concrete park. I'm used to concrete parks because I grew up on one. So like that doesn't scare me. But I hadn't dropped in on a skateboard in forever. Like I ride weekly throughout the neighborhood with the dogs and kids and stuff. But dropping in at my advanced age of 37 on a concrete quarter pipe, even though it was like a 6 foot quarter pipe, man, that was horrifying for me. I did it. But it was nice. Definitely a little scary there. What's the best trick you ever hit ever in your entire life?
So I like I make a lot of parallels between like my skateboarding journey and also like learning to code, because I was so bad. Like it took me probably 3 years before I even landed a kickflip. But I think the mentality of just like keep on trying. And like that kind of is definitely paralleled to like everything else I do. It's just like just try it till you make it work. I've never been really that good. Early days, I landed maybe like two or three 360 flips. Wow. These days, I also keep it pretty simple because I don't want to break anything. I've got my like just basic kick flips. I like to do little shove-its. And then I like bull skating too. So I'll do like little like slappy grinds and then just like rock to fakies and stuff like that.
That freaks me out, but I love that you can do that.
That's sweet. And you bought a Syntax deck, right?
I did. Yeah. It's right here. I made a little like a small little video for Twitter of like just doing a few tricks.
For some reason, sorry, I totally missed that when you had posted it, which was a bummer. I saw you posted it again when we announced you, and I was like, this is sick. This is really nice.
No, thanks.
Little did you know, you could have gotten a Syntax deck for free just months later.
No, it's so funny. Like, I mean, I kind of felt like that video I made was almost like a sponsor me tape. So like there's this whole idea when you're growing up skateboarding of like,
I know all about this. Yeah.
Yeah. You try to get your best tricks and you want to get it on film and you want to get sponsored. So that was like a Syntax sponsor me tape basically.
Yeah. I was a rollerblader more than a skateboarder, and I got to like do Vans skate park openings, and I was deep in that world, man, of trying to get major sponsorships or gear or anything from anybody. I had many a tape. Yeah, that's actually how I got into video, which is kind of how I got into here, you know, skate video, whatever. And you know, now I'm doing video as a career.
What's that camera that everybody used to film?
Oh, yeah,
there's a really good documentary
the Sony
on
with the
it.
Handle. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like the fisheye lens.
Yeah.
FX10? No, obviously not. I just like going in my search history.
I rented one in college, and it was like I got to live out my skate dreams.
The VX1000.
VX1000, yeah, classic.
I'm going to put a link to the VX1000. Red Bull did a documentary on the camera, and it's super interesting. And now, like, I go to a lot of garage sales and thrift stores, so I'm like, always on the hunt now. One day I'm going to find one, and yeah. I'm going to swap out my nice high quality camera with that and just do a podcast via nice. That thing.
Well, so this weekend I actually found something. I'll show you.
I was going to say this would be perfect for a set. Yeah.
It is a Sony Mavica. So it's the exact opposite of high quality. It runs on floppy disk. Let me see if I can get the floppy disk.
No way.
That sound.
Floppy disk.
And this specific model was from 99, but I think it came out like in 97. But yeah, I found this at the thrift store on Friday. And like yesterday I was going around taking photos. My wife was like trying to hide her face because like, look at this old giant camera. But it's so sick. Like there's something to be said about like that mechanical sound of like the floppy going in.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that sounds good. Yeah.
And then you can like, I don't know if it's coming across on the mic, but you can like hear it spinning when it turns on. I don't know.
I have a mini DV camera I've been ripping stuff from lately because I just wanted to rip all my mini DV onto my computer. And that thing sounds like it's truly struggling every time it pulls in a tape. It's like, it's like the worst, the exact opposite of that lovely sound.
Yeah.
Do we have anything else we want to hit, Wes?
I think we should do some sick picks.
Cool. All right, let's get into the part of the show where we're talking about sick picks and shameless plugs. We pick things that we like or enjoy. CJ, is there anything in your life that you would want to sick pick?
I am going to sick pick the idea of ergonomics. Especially starting this new job, like I've made sure that I have like the right desk set up and everything. I started to get wrist issues a while back where like it got to the point where like I couldn't even use my right wrist. And so I actually switched to using a left-handed mouse, left-handed vertical mouse. Vertical mice, anything to get your setup so that you're at 90 degree angles. So like make sure your arms are at 90 degree when you're using your keyboard. Make sure your feet are touching the ground. My sick pick is ergonomics, because if you don't do it early on, you will start to feel it later in life for sure.
That's too true. Too true. Wes, do you have a sick pick?
I'm going to sick pick a pizza cutter that my sister got me for Christmas, and I freaking love this thing. I'm not one for, I've talked about it a few times on the show, I'm not one for like kitchen gadgets, you know? Often people will get me kitchen stuff, and I'm just like, that seems like a bit of a gimmick. But this is a pizza cutter that is basically just a wheel, and it flips back, and you can just roll it over the pizza. Instead of having like a handle on it, you just grab the actual wheel itself, and it's so much better than a regular pizza cutter. It says kitschy on it, but I just did a quick Google. It seems like there's a million people that sell this type of thing, and it comes apart really easily. You throw it right in the dishwasher. It's super sharp, and every time I've used it like 10 times now. We pizza quite a bit with the kids, and it's just like, man, this is definitely one that I will sick pick after having it for a while. So check it out. I'll link up the one I got in the show notes.
I'm going to sick pick. We talked about Project Farm on here before. It's a YouTube channel where this guy does these really intricate tests for all sorts of things. And like, I got into this because he was testing like, you know, impact drivers and stuff. But he's since moved on to all kinds of different things. And his most recent video is what I'm sick picking explicitly. This is ridiculous. He tested all of the different trash bags that exist, and he put them through so many different tests. And I'm just sick picking this trash bag test video. I told Courtney that I was watching a nearly 30-minute video on trash bag tests, and she just was like, what are you doing with your life? But I gotta say, I learned a lot about trash bags. And the most interesting thing about this video is this guy manages to create the most amazing tests for this stuff. And I just really appreciate that. The programming mind would love to create these kind of stress tests and endurance tests. I just think about how this would translate into code at any given time.
I love it.
This trash bag one specifically was a blast to watch.
The amount of times I've done that trash bag, or we don't call them trash in Canada, garbage bag, like rabbit hole, is nuts. Like at our cottage, we're only allowed clear garbage bags. So like I had to go down, and there's so many ones that rip, and they're meant for leaves, or they're meant for like storing like clothes. And I finally found one that is is nice and big and doesn't rip. And like, I finally found it and I just went and I bought 20 boxes of them. And I just, it was like $200. And I was like, I'll never in my life, like it's probably like 8 years worth of garbage bags, you know, and just never have to think about it ever again. They're not going to go bad. Yes. You know, I just love when you find something like that in your life and you're just like, that's it. I'm done.
I was happy to see that the Kirkland brand, which is the ones I already bought, were like third place in the listing.
The Drumliner or the smaller, the regular ones?
I think that, I don't know what Drumliner is. I don't know if we even have those. We just got regular old trash bags. Regular,
just American sized. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We have, they're called industrial Drumliners. Those are the ones we buy. They're the best.
Nice.
We're only allowed like one bag of garbage. So I did the research and found the biggest garbage bag you could possibly buy.
Make it count. Yeah.
Shameless plugs. CJ, what would you like to plug?
I guess a coding garden. If you visit coding.garden, it has links to all my stuff, Twitch, YouTube, Twitter, all that. So yeah.
Yeah. And CJ is going to be producing regular content on the Syntax YouTube channel. My shameless plug will be the Syntax YouTube channel. The podcast is in a video form. If you want to see CJ's luscious wall of greenery behind him right now, head on over to YouTube and check it out. It's at Syntax FM on YouTube.
Yeah. And let us know if there's something that you want us to see. Because like one request I just got, again, probably once every couple weeks, someone says, hey, why do you never do Vue content? And the answer to that is because me and Scott are not Vue developers, but CJ is. So CJ can certainly whip up a little Vue content, especially if somebody's like interested in learning a few things. So let us know. Just tweet us at SyntaxFM or however you like to get in touch.
Sick.
Yeah, that's it. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll catch you later. Peace.
Peace.
Peace.